Before we get started with today's episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight, we want to let you know that we have exclusive bonus content on Patreon at patreon.com/ampedup. You can find the video versions of all our interviews, as well as bonus content with me, Ryan's producer, Rob Bermudez. So make sure you check out our bonus content today at patreon.com/ampedup. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Eric London. Eric is a writer for the World Socialist website. Eric, welcome to Amped Up.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm very excited you could join us this week. So we're going to talk about the AOC controversy today and the broader implications that this story has on the left and this whole strategy that many leftists are still clinging onto, that the Democratic Party can be reformed, despite the fact that the strategy has been an abject failure. So first, for some context, for people who haven't been following AOC's recent actions, in an interview with the Democratic Socialists of America magazine, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez attacked socialist critics of the Biden administration as quote-unquote privileged and bad faith actors. And since this interview dropped, things got even worse. Last week, AOC tried to say that Biden's cruelty at the border is somehow better than Trump's cruelty was at the border, despite the fact that Trump caged children and Biden is still caging children. And then a few days ago, we find out that it was revealed that AOC transferred grassroots campaign donations to corporate Democrats who oppose Medicare for All and who support endless wars. And I just want to be clear about something before we kind of start off the conversation. I do not believe that the main problem in this country is AOC or any single member of Congress for that matter. I wholeheartedly believe that the main problem in this country and in this world is our decrepit capitalist and imperialist system that both corporate parties preserve and protect. But with that said, AOC and the squad were sent to Congress to fight back against this corrupt system, not defend it like the corporate politicians do. Eric, you wrote a great piece responding to all of this in the World Socialist website, and I want to read a paragraph from your article and then get your analysis. You write, and I quote, AOC's defense of the right wing of the Democratic Party against socialist opposition reveals her role in preempting the development of a movement of the working class independent of the two-party system. She is the latest iteration of a strategy developed by the Democratic Party over 200 years to present a quote-unquote left face in order to trap social opposition, prop up the capitalist order, and carry out ruthless attacks on the working class in the United States and internationally. Fundamental lessons must be drawn from this experience. I think the reason your article hit home with me and so many others is that this story is so much bigger than just being about AOC. AOC is just the latest Democratic figure who campaigned and presented themselves as a leftist and then slowly started moving right as soon as they get power. Can you talk about this historical pattern by the Democratic Party to use figures like AOC, not to advance progress, but to actually stop the left from gaining real power in this country?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me, Ryan. First, it really requires us to place this present episode in the broader international political context. And I'll get to your question. But first, there have been in the United States now 570,000 people who have died in the coronavirus pandemic.
Right.
And across the world, it's above now 2.9 million people who have died in the span of a year. In the US, the number of excess deaths caused by the collapse of the healthcare system is 500,000. In addition. And now, actually, just yesterday, it's been reported that there are about 40,000 children who have lost a parent to COVID. And in this context, the degree of wealth inequality has grown to such an extraordinary extent. The billionaires increased their wealth last year by 60%, 60%. Meanwhile, the indices of social misery for the broad masses of the working class internationally have gone off the charts. The World Economic Forum reported that 500 million people were going to be thrown into poverty this year. 1.6 billion workers in the informal economy have lost their jobs or substantial portions of their income. And the loss in labor income for the working class globally last year alone was over $3 trillion. Mm-hmm. Now, you think about how this, that's why I want to give that initial answer, because the Democratic Party and the American ruling class, and this applies globally, but they're very aware of massive social opposition to such profoundly unthinkable levels of inequality, which dominate every aspect of life in every country on the planet. And so when the interview with Ocasio-Cortez came out in the Democratic Left, as you said, the magazine of the Democratic Socialists of America, in which she was attacking left-wing opponents of Biden, calling them bad faith actors, the World Socialist website didn't so much see this as a phenomenon involving her as an individual, but rather that the another sign that the Democratic Party is aware of the danger of social revolution, aware of the danger of socialism, which is becoming more popular. And so they're using her as part. I'm happy to discuss some of this 200-year history of this rotten party called the Democrats.
Please.
But yes, as you say, this was an attempt, and this is really how the bourgeoisie thinks. It's how the capitalist class thinks, to keep this opposition within the Democratic Party, where it could be disarmed, where it could be defanged, and ultimately directed in support of the right-wing aims of the Biden administration.
Yeah, I mean, and the reason so many of us, you know, myself included, called out AOC's recent actions is they are a perfect example of how the project to reform the capitalist and imperialist Democratic Party has been a failure. And you often hear people say that, you know, you can't change the system from within, the system changes you. But I think that even misses the point. And I think some of the statistics you just listed off, I would add to the fact that now there's now 2,153 billionaires in the world. And they now hoard more wealth than 60% of the planet's population, which is the equivalent of 4.6 billion people. Just 2,000 billionaires hoard more wealth than 4.6 billion people. This is a capitalist economy that is unsustainable. It has gone way off the rails, and it is an economy that cannot be reformed. So I think the question people really should be asking themselves is a system like capitalism that is rooted in the exploitation of the poor and the working class, can you even reform a system like that at all? Because once you start asking that question, it really opens people's eyes up to the fact that it's not about saving or reforming capitalism, but it's about fighting for a new economic system that is rooted in justice and dignity for all people. Do you believe, Eric, that capitalism can be reformed, or is it time for this world to move beyond capitalism and towards socialism?
Well, it's not a question of what I believe, Ryan. It just can't be reformed. That's the nature of it. The Democratic Party, and this is something which is important to distinguish, the Democratic Party is not an institution which can be separated from capitalism. It can't be separated from the American state. It is a party of the CIA. It is a party of the FBI. It's a party of the prison system. It is a party which has on its hands the blood of millions of people who have been killed by American imperialism in every corner of the world over the course of more than 100 years. So that's the Democratic Party. It's a party that is run by the banks and corporations. It's run for the banks and corporations. And it's a party which, in distinction from its Republican counterpart, has a special history. And that is that its role has been, since its founding in 1828, when Andrew Jackson and Martin Van Buren were the brainchilds behind the party, was set up in particular to block the growth of social opposition. That's not just something that the World Socialist website says, that's a historical fact. That is its purpose. And over the course of two centuries of American capitalism, centuries which were marked by the forced removal of the Native Americans, in the Democratic Party's case, the defense of slavery, the erection of Jim Crow legislation in the South, the crushing of the massive social struggles of the working class in the post-Civil War period, in a period which was basically called the Long Labor War from the 1870s through the 1930s. And at each stage, the Democratic Party is there both to institutionalize left-wing opposition, that is, to bring it within the framework of the two-party system and thereby preserve the two-party system, and to block the development of an independent party of the working class. So that's why in Europe, it's complicated because it's also bound up with the emergence of American capitalism, the availability of land, etc. But America's domination in the First and Second World War, but that accounts for why there was a Labour Party in Britain, why there was a social democratic movement in Central Europe and Southern Europe. That, of course, never took place here. And that's primarily because of the role played by the Democratic Party.
And I think it's so important that you talk about the history of the party, because the best way to understand today is to look back at history. And just hearing just the history of the party, that it has, since its inception, been a party that has kind of presented itself as a left party to actually block any progress in this country to the left. I think that is what, as someone who was a Democrat for 18 years, I'll personally attest to the fact that that was the part that continually fooled me. You know, the Democrats have become masters of deception, where they find people like a Barack Obama who just sedate the public with these great platitudes of hope and change. And then, you know, the public gives the party power, and then the party gets into power and it does the exact opposite. It doesn't actually fight for hope and change. It doesn't fight for justice and dignity for all people and for the working class. It governs for Wall Street and giant corporations and the ruling class. But it's the trickery, right? You know, the Republicans, they're never out there claiming that they're the party of the working class, or that they're the party of women, or that they're the party of black people and LGBTQ people. They're pretty brazen with their corruption. They're like, yeah, we're going to war, right? Or, you know, yeah, we're giving big tax breaks to billionaires and giant corporations. You know, they've always kind of been honest about the fact that they represent big business. But it's the Democrats who, you know, deceive the people and say, we're on your side, but then turn around and just represent big business like the Republicans. And I think that is what more people are starting to wake up to. And I think when you can look at the history part, but then let's just look at recent history. Let's look at the last 4 years. The DNC and the corporatists who control the Democratic Party, they did everything to stop a true progressive, a progressive like Bernie Sanders, from running in the Democratic DNC primary. They did everything possible to stop them. I would argue they fought harder to stop Bernie Sanders than they ever fought to stop Donald Trump. And I just think it's really kind of short-sighted for leftists who still think you can reform the party from within, that they think that they didn't give Bernie a fair shot. You think that the next progressive who tries to run inside the party in 2024 and 2028, you don't think they're going to also rig it against them and rig it for the preferred corporate candidate like a Buttigieg or a Kamala Harris who will protect corporate power and kind of placate the people with these empty platitudes? I mean, this is just going to keep repeating itself over and over again until the left wakes up, realizes they're in an abusive relationship, and that the only way to end an abusive relationship is to leave it. That's it.
Well, the recent history is very important. And you indicated Barack Obama first to begin with. 2008 was massive opposition to the war in Iraq, to the fact that foreclosures were skyrocketing, that social misery and suffering and unemployment were at levels that they hadn't been since the Great Depression. And they bring along this senator from Illinois who calls himself a community organizer, which your ears should always perk up when you hear that someone's a community organizer, because it doesn't really mean anything. And it's always used by the Democratic Party to present someone as left-wing when, in fact, they have no connection whatsoever to social struggles. In fact, Ocasio-Cortez also calls herself a community organizer, when in reality, she was an entrepreneur and a Democratic staffer and really had no connection to any strike or social protest movement. But this moniker is attached to present them as representatives of the people. But as you say, I mean, then you take 2008, 2009, Barack Obama supports the bailout of the banks. The wars continue. The surge to Afghanistan takes place. Guantanamo fills up, remains open, etc. And at the end of this eight-year process, there is even more opposition. None of the problems have been resolved. Trillions have been handed over to the banks. People are saddled with all sorts of debt. There's now wars in Syria, in Libya, in East Africa, all over the world, which were launched by the Democratic Party. Coup launched in Honduras by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And Sanders comes along in 2016. Now, you know, I wouldn't call Sanders a true progressive. Sanders is in the same vein as Ocasio-Cortez. He was an earlier iteration of the same fundamental process, where he ran in 2016 in order to try and trap the left-wing opposition that had developed particularly against the Obama administration. I think he probably more than anybody else was surprised by the amount of support that he got. The Democrats weren't afraid of him as an individual because he's been a loyal caucus member for 30 years. But they were startled by the fact that someone who called himself a socialist was winning primaries in Iowa, in Michigan, in working class areas of the country.
Right.
And so after 2016, yes, as you say, I mean, there's no question he was completely cheated out of the election in 2016 and 2020. But he went along with it in both cases. After having lambasted Hillary Clinton as a stooge of the banks and of the war machine and a friend of Henry Kissinger, he then traveled the country telling his supporters that they had to vote for her. And then tried the first as tragedy, second as farce, as Marx said, probably thinking to 150 years earlier about the Sanders primary elections. And then that's when Ocasio-Cortez emerges. And just in relation to the Democratic Socialists of America, why this is important is because the Democratic Socialists of America are the organization which provides her with her socialist crown. Evidently, what she says, which is new in this interview that we reported on the World Socialist website, is that she only joined the DSA after she had been selected by brand new Congress, this Democratic Party organization, to be a candidate. And that's very significant because, and we can get into this as well, the Democratic Socialists of America were working within the Democratic Party to provide Ocasio-Cortez with the left-wing credentials that she lacked from her personal life in order to present her as the Democrats wanted, as this beacon of socialist official socialism.
There's a part where you write about the DSA, and I wanted to get into that. You write, and I quote, "The DSA, like Ocasio-Cortez, has no connection to the struggle to the struggles of the working class, let alone socialism. Since the founding of its predecessor, the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, in 1972, and the DSA in 1982, the organization has existed as a continuous presence within the Democratic Party. For 50 years, its operatives have attended Democratic National Conventions, worked as staff for Democratic Party politicians, and fought for a realignment within the party. Over this time period, the Democratic Party has turned further to the right, abandoning any pretense at social reform. And while the DSA has served as a left shield for the Democratic Party's rightward maneuvers, assuring the population that the Democratic Party can be reformed as it launches imperialist wars across the world and eviscerates social programs and corporate regulations." You know, the reason, you know, I'm so critical of AOC and the DSA is I think they have the potential to break the left free of the Democratic Party, which I believe is the only path to any fundamental change via electoral politics. Because as long as the left has no true electoral vehicle of our own, the DNC will take progressive voters for granted and just keep serving their corporate donors. But instead of actually breaking the left free of the Democratic Party, AOC and the DSA are doing the exact opposite. They're driving the left deeper into the Democratic Party. You know, and I'm constantly, constantly reprimanded online as being counterproductive for criticizing AOC and the DSA. But in my opinion, what's counterproductive is AOC and the DSA funneling leftists into a right-wing capitalist and imperialist party that fights against socialism. Eric, can you specifically talk about the DSA's role both historically and currently in providing cover for the Democratic Party and why it's so important for leftists to be critical of DSA, especially when DSA isn't using their organization right now to hold the Democratic Party accountable? You talk about all these statistics of inequality, which are true. I mean, we are living in a time of historic levels of inequality. And AOC and the Squad and even Bernie, they're not even fighting for social reform. The Democratic Party isn't even fighting for, you know, strong structural policies like Medicare for All, you know, like raising the minimum wage to a living wage of $24 an hour, you know, like reparations, or, you know, like the Green New Deal, or like a monthly UBI. I mean, this latest relief package was all temporary. It's like a one-time $1,800 check. So, you know, that to me is the glaring problem here, is that you can't even get the Democratic Party to support strong social reforms.
Well, let's consider, if you consider the Democratic Party's operation to crush social opposition, bring it under the control of its own apparatus, the DSA for the last 50 years has been the keystone in the architecture, you could say, of this operation. So the DSA is founded in 1982. And by the way, I'll say as an initial point, I've been hearing from a lot of DSA members who are very hostile to what Ocasio-Cortez said and who are telling me they didn't join the DSA because they thought it was the Democratic Party. But to be crystal clear, the DSA is the Democratic Party. It is entirely a faction of the Democratic Party. It's not at all an independent organization. And in order to understand, I'm not saying that because the Socialist Equality Party is a different tendency. I'm saying that because if you read their history, what they say about themselves, that becomes very clear. So, and cut me off if you want, but the history here is really important and it does merit some detail. So in 1982, the DSA is founded. And it's founded out of a merger with the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, DSOC, and an organization which had come out of Students for a Democratic Society called the New America Foundation. I'm sorry, the New America Movement, the NAM. And the DSOC was founded in 1972 or 1973. And that was founded by Michael Harrington, who also later became the founder and leader of DSA. Harrington is a very important figure. He was a member of the Shachmanite movement, which is named after Max Shachman, who had at one point been a supporter of Leon Trotsky, had at one point been in the socialist movement, who broke from Trotskyism in a split which took place within the Trotskyist movement. And over the course of the next decades, moved very, very far to the right. He ended up endorsing, Shachman did, the Bay of Pigs invasion. And he was a supporter of the American imperialism in the Korean War, and ultimately supported the American invasion of Vietnam. So Harrington is an acolyte, really the protege of Max Shachman. That's an important element to realize because the DSA is a pro-imperialist organization. The membership may not like war, but the organization as a whole is without a doubt an imperialist, supporting the Democratic Party, supporting imperialist policy.
Right.
So in 72, they launched this, the DSOC launches what they call Democratic Agenda. And that becomes then Democracy 76, I think they call it. And it's entirely within the Democratic conventions. In 1978, they then wage a campaign within what the Democratic Party apparently used to have midterm conventions, all to try and push the Democrats to the left. Now, and then they do the same in 1984, 1988. Throughout the 1990s, they're working entirely within the Progressive Caucus of the Democratic Party. And this is from their own documents. I encourage everybody to go read an article called A History of Democratic Socialists of America by Joseph Schwartz. And you read between the lines, but this is very clear. So it's an organization which is trying to pressure the Democrats while the Democratic Party is moving toward what it is today, which is abandoning any pretense of social reform. So right. that's where the DSA comes from.
And to be fair, I think many of the DSA supporters, I mean, I've spoken with quite a few, they do support a clean or a dirty break from the Democratic Party, but it's the national leadership, as you point out in your article, who are opposed to it and have for 50 years unsuccessfully tried to reform the Democratic Party. Do you think that AOC's latest actions will encourage more people within the DSA to push for a clean break from the Democratic Party?
Ocasio-Cortez's interview has thrown the DSA into crisis. It's thrown the Democratic Party into crisis. The response which the World Socialist website has received to the initial article and to the coverage which we have subsequently done has been read by well over 100,000 people. We have been receiving dozens of messages from DSA members who are expressing their hostility. This is why I think this gives you a sense of what
their hostility to you or to the DSA.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Yeah. No, to the Democratic Socialists of America leadership. And that's what this whole event shows. Again, the DSA is scrambling to try and convince those people to remain in their organization and to continue to fight for what they call an inside out approach. Now, what that really means is an entirely inside approach with, pressure tactics from the outside. Pressure is always to be brought to bear on the Democratic Party. And in fact, the Democratic Party, as the Sanders campaign only clarified twice, is responding to pressure by moving further to the right.
Just to interject here, I find that so almost comical that one of their objectives, DSAs, is to pressure the Democratic Party, because they're not. The DSA, they're so focused on their numbers, and they are right now the biggest socialist organization in the country, and I think it's great. They claim they have over 95,000 members, I think maybe even more now, but what's the point of building power if you're not going to use your power to fight back against the corrupt establishment? And the DSA is not only are they not using their power to pressure Joe Biden, they're actually not even using their organization to hold AOC accountable and to hold the squad accountable, who's also not fighting back and pressuring Joe Biden. I mean, just this year, we've seen the squad refuse to force the vote on Medicare for All. We saw them refuse to demand concessions in order to vote for Pelosi. We saw them refuse also to fight back and force Joe Biden to push for the $15 minimum wage. And now we're seeing them defend and apologize for the establishment. And that is not what they were sent to Congress to do. They were sent to Congress to fight back against the establishment, not join it. And what else I think is fascinating is they've also built up these kind of big personalities the DSA has on Twitter. And not only are these big accounts not pressuring AOC or pressuring Biden, they're actually pressuring people like me and other independent voices to stop talking about AOC and stop actually reporting on what AOC said and did, because it makes her look bad and it makes the DSA look bad. So instead of pressuring the Democratic Party, they're actually pressuring people like me and you and from what I've seen, other independent voices from actually calling out just the objective analysis of what we're seeing from AOC, how we're seeing her move to the right, not to the left.
Well, that's because that is the Democratic Party. Again, there isn't a distinction between the DSA and the Democratic Party. The DSA for 50 years has functioned within the Democratic Party, within the Carter administration. Harrington actually was an advisor on a council that was set up by Lyndon Johnson, who was dropping thousands of tons of napalm on the peasants and workers of Vietnam. And actually, in Harrington's case, if you really want to get into the pro-imperialist roots of the DSA, Harrington and Max Shackman were supporting an organization in the anti-war movement called Negotiations Now, which was an attempt to, as they explicitly said at the time, an attempt to really keep socialists out of the anti-war movement and to prevent the anti-Vietnam War movement from breaking free of the Democratic Party. And Harrington was actually a supporter in the 72 convention of the Democratic Party of McGovern. Anyway, these issues become important now because it does clarify, I would say, to those who are watching and to those who are trying to draw whatever they can from this experience, we would, at the World Socialist website, advise them as follows. Take the lesson from this, that the study of the historical experiences of the class struggle is the most essential issue right now for you. Study the 150-year history of the socialist movement and try and grapple with the very big questions. There was a revolution in Russia in 1917, but why did the Russian Revolution, which was led by Lenin and Leon Trotsky, and we're a Trotskyist organization, why did Stalin emerge in the Soviet Union, and why did a police state dictatorship emerge, which slaughtered hundreds of thousands of supporters of Trotsky, including by assassinating Trotsky himself in Mexico City in 1940? What were the lessons of the struggle against Stalinism? What was the Spanish Civil War? Anyway, these are all questions which you really have to dedicate yourself to, because you see the Democratic Party relies on low level of historical understanding to pull these operations off. And if people understand and learn the lessons of history, that's how these operations will lose their effect. But the World Socialist website would also say to people, there is a working class. There is, on this planet of 7 billion people, a working class which comprises of about 90% of the population. And whether it's a worker in Latin America or Africa or the center of world imperialism in New York City or in Paris, France or London, England, the working class, no matter their race, no matter their orientation or gender, have fundamental class interests. And they are not only the exploited social force under capitalism, but they're also the revolutionary social force. And the challenge is to take all of these historical experiences, because the working class doesn't, they're lied to by the media, they're lied to by the parties. Everything is in bad faith. That's what bad faith really is in politics. It's bourgeois politics based on lies and tricks and threats and xenophobia and divide and conquer and all of this. So what our job is as socialists, and this is what the Socialist Equality Party stands for, is to take this immense historical experience, all the lessons of the past defeats, and these are life and death questions, and educate the working class, transform this powerful social force from a class which is not aware of its revolutionary potential into a class that is. And that is just, stop worrying, I would say, not saying this to you, Ryan, necessarily, but stop worrying so much about who's running in the Democratic primary or what this or that Democratic, we have to pay attention, obviously, I'm not saying ignore them, but orient yourself to the working class. That's who is going to, that is going to be the social force which transforms all of world history.
That's very well said. And I think that's kind of one of the ways that the two-party system distracts us, is they make everything about electoral politics, right? And they dominate the conversation because, you know, of the corporate media, you know? And so you have the Fox News dominates the conversation on the right, and then you have MSNBC and CNN who dominate the conversation. I'm not even gonna call it the left because it's not the left, but, you know, in this kind of center right, which is actually just more right wing, but it presents itself as liberal and left. And so it kind of just, you know, we're from the moment you're born in this country, they indoctrinate us into this kind of capitalist system. And they only tell us that we can have two choices, right? You're either a blue capitalist or a red capitalist. And for, you know, I was stuck in that that paradigm for a long time, for almost 18 years, until finally I woke up and thought and saw that, like, no, like, it doesn't matter if you're a member of the blue team or the red team, because they both serve the same corporate masters. You know, they both work for the same big businesses and for the military industrial complex, and just to feed more money to the ruling class. And they work against the interests of the majority of the people in this country. But like you just said so brilliantly, they divide us, you know, they divide us against each other. And I think the moment you realize that a better world is possible and you get outside of just the two-party way of thinking, then you start to see that, like, there's a world of possibility out there. But they trap us in this kind of, no, you know, if you don't vote every election cycle, I've been hearing since I was 18 years old, that if you don't vote for the Democratic Party, democracy will die. It's the same message every 4 years. And what I woke up to last cycle, finally, when they told us that if you don't vote for Joe Biden, you know, democracy will die. And I actually even remember the t-shirts. There were t-shirts in like 2004 that said vote or die, and all the celebrities wore them. But what I find so just interesting about it is the whole premise is a lie, because the United States of America is not even a democracy, right? It is an oligarchy. It is a corporate oligarchy. And no matter which party, corporate party, wins the election, the wars continue, the inequality continues, the injustice continues, because the problem is the system. That is our capitalist system that both parties preserve and protect. And so when you finally realize that the Democrats are just selling you fear, and then Republicans do the same thing. They say, oh, you know, vote for us because the Democrats are destroying America. You know, they each kind of have this message that is rooted in scaring the electorate and keeping the electorate divided. And when you finally realize that both messages are BS and are wrong, that's when you get into a socialist mindset and you see, and I think the reason both parties fight so hard against socialism is because socialism is like a mirror to capitalism. It kind of holds up a mirror and it's like, this is what you guys are really doing. You're putting children in cages at the border. You're engaging in endless wars. You're exploiting the poor and the working class, not just in this country, but in other countries, when you engage in imperialism and you go in and bomb and invade other countries and engage in these regime change wars and exploit their resources just to enrich the oligarchs back here at home. And so when you really see all that, then you start to realize we can build something better, that something that the world will never change. If, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Voting for either of these corrupt parties is doing the same thing over and over again, and it's just going to lead us down this road to annihilation. Really, and then you factor in the climate crisis and you really see that, like, there is, when people say to me that third parties or, you know, socialist parties are a dead end movement, I just laugh and look back at them. I'm like, no, what the dead end movement is both of these capitalist parties that don't care about the people or the planet. They just care about maximizing profits for their corporate donors and for themselves. I think that's another thing people don't realize. Both of these capitalist parties are using our government to not just enrich their corporate donors, but to enrich themselves. The majority of Congress members themselves are now millionaires. And so the entire system is corrupt. You know, there's not a lesser evil. The entire system is evil and it cannot be reformed.
Well, the other aspect, I agree, the other aspect of this is that socialism has to be international. There is no national solution to the crisis of world capitalism. Capitalism is an international system. Corporations are transnational, and so the position of the World Trotskyist movement. If I could just make a point about this, because
please,
for those of you who may not be familiar, but I mentioned earlier, Leon Trotsky led the Russian Revolution and then the what was initially known as the Left Opposition. That was the opposition to the bureaucratic caste, which emerged in the Soviet Union in the years following the Russian Revolution. There's many complicated reasons for why such a caste arose, but the isolation of the Russian Revolution was one fundamental reason. The relative backwardness of the Russian economy after 300 years of Romanov rule, and our movement, the Trotskyist movement, sought to explain that the degeneration of the Soviet Union did not mean that socialism inevitably resulted in dictatorship. But that also drawing from this experience and from the writings of Marx and Engels and Mehring and the classical Marxist theoreticians of the 19th century and early 20th century, the theory of permanent revolution emerges, which was the theory that Trotsky developed, that socialism requires, on the one hand, the political independence of the working class from all the organizations of capitalist rule, and also the international unity of the working class. And that, I think, is another fundamental aspect which people have to really understand, is that that none of the problems which exist under capitalism are going to be solved in the United States alone. In a major way, the whole concept of national socialism was disproven in the Soviet Union, which the Soviet Union could not, under the pressure of globalization and the immense power of world imperialism, was dissolved in 1989-1991. But these are the reason why I'm stressing these historical questions is because I think that in the United States in particular, there is a tendency among those who are newly radicalized as well to see, you know, sort of activity as the means and the end. That is that, well, it doesn't really matter. Let's go out and knock on doors for Ocasio-Cortez. That will somehow advance the cause for socialism. But what we really need now is to, what do we do after this experience with AOC and with Sanders? We have to really think, and that's the answer, to think and to study and to try and understand. Yes, I agree with the conclusions you're drawing about the two-party system. And that's fundamental, but it's not enough. Right. And that's, I think, what people really have. Now, I'm not making a case for passivity. I mean, the Socialist Equality Party right now in the United States, in Germany, in Sri Lanka, in Australia, in every country where we have a section, is fighting to develop rank and file committees in the working class. That is at Amazon, among airport workers in Germany, among tea plantation workers in Sri Lanka, among warehouse workers in Australia, and to develop a movement of rank and file committees that stretches and links workers connected by the process of production in one massive social struggle against the entire, not just what this corporation or this billionaire, but against the capitalist system as a whole.
You, back to the article, you write, and I quote, "A genuine socialist movement will not be born out of the Democratic Party. All pragmatic arguments for using the Democratic ballot line, for appealing to the better angels of reactionary Democratic politicians, and for a quote-unquote inside-out strategy, partly inside the Democratic Party and partly pressuring it from without, clash with the historical role played by this party in defense of the capitalist system. The Democratic Party is an imperialist party representing the corporate oligarchy. It is accountable to the military, the intelligence agencies, the banks, and the corporations. At times, it presents itself in progressive terms, but only to block the growth of a genuine socialist movement. It is irreconcilably hostile to the interests of the working class, full stop, and that will never change." See, this to me is the most important part of your article, because we are never going to be able to create the kind of energy needed to build a genuine socialist movement and working class party so long as people are in denial about who the Democratic Party really is. It is not a left party. It is not a progressive party, and it is definitely not a socialist party. The Democratic Party is a right-wing capitalist and imperialist party, and the Republican Party is a far-right party. We have essentially two major right-wing parties in America that represent big business and the ruling class, and zero major left parties that represent the working class. Eric, how have the Democrats been able to get away with this lie for so long that they are a left party? And as a member of the Socialist Equality Party yourself, what does a genuine socialist party and movement look like for people?
Well, they've been able to get away with it so long precisely because organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America present the Democratic Party with a sort of left veneer. That's been the case for over a century with organizations which precede the DSA. In the 1930s, for example, the Communist Party, that is the Stalinist Party, was a member of the New Deal Popular Front. They supported the Roosevelt administration. They attacked workers who wanted to strike during the Second World War. So this is not the first, I'm not just making this point about the Democratic Socialists of America, but the role played by, the reason why real socialists have to really attack the political orientation put forward by the leadership of the DSA and other groups like Socialist Alternative, who also have fundamentally the same, after all, they've just sent a number of their members, including City Councilwoman Kshama Sawant, into the DSA. Now that's a major step. They've entered the Democratic Party. That's the product of an orientation which they've taken.
Because I have spoken with Kshama on this show about why she joined the DSA, and she argues, and I think it's just fair to present her argument, she still organizes and is a part of Socialist Alternative, that is a Marxist tendency. But she joined the DSA, and others from Socialist Alternative joined the DSA to bring the kind of revolutionary Marxist perspective that it's lacking, and to encourage them to break away from the Democratic Party. That is according to Kshama. And look, as much criticism as I've given the DSA, I would strongly support the DSA to break away from the Democratic Party. You know, I think that would be a very important development. I think that's actually the only useful thing that DSA could do for the left in this country, for the working class in this country, is to break away from the party. So if anyone wants to do the hard work of trying to, you know, to get in there and bring the revolutionary perspective that the Democratic Party cannot be reformed, and that the DSA is actually standing in the way of progress, and they need to break away from the Democratic Party for the working class to see any real victories, I would be in support of that. But I think it's also safe, it's very fair to argue that that is not what's happening right now with the DSA's national leadership. I don't see any effort from them to break away or to even actually hold the current Democratic leadership accountable and encourage them to actually fight for social reform like Medicare for All and a living wage.
Now, just there was a second part of your question, which I'll answer, but just quickly to respond to that. I think on the issue of city council person Sawant, first of all, the World Socialist website has opposed the effort to recall her. It's a completely anti-democratic right. She was elected. She should be able to still, we disagree with her politically, but we also
And just for some context for people who don't realize, there is a right-wing recall campaign in Seattle that's being led by big business and corporations to try to remove her from office, despite the fact that she was elected. And the reason I have appreciation for Kshama is that she got elected as an independent socialist. She didn't run in the party. And I think that
endorsed by a number of Democratic Party organizations and congresspeople.
She didn't run in the party, which I think is important that she is independent of the Democratic Party. I mean, she didn't run under the party, which I am encouraging everyone when they're running for office to not run as a Democrat. You know, until we do have a vehicle, until we do have a leftist party that, is more organized, I encourage everyone to run independently if they want to try to make any change in electoral politics, because I just don't think you can. I think, as we've seen with the Squad, they're not able to pressure the Democratic Party on the inside while they're actually serving under the Democratic Party. I think that independence is what's important. And I would even argue that, as much as you would say Bernie hasn't been effective, I would say that Bernie, over his 30 years, has been much more effective than the Squad has been so far. And I would say that it's his independence that is important, is an important piece of that.
Well, you know the World Socialist website's position on this, those who are watching can read what we have to say. As for your question though about what does a socialist party look like, and I do think, in contrast to the DSA and Socialist Alternative, a socialist party a real revolutionary socialist party tells workers the truth. It doesn't try to mince words. It doesn't have, oh, sure, we're working within the Democratic Party, but we're really against it. Or, oh, sure, we're against the DSA, but we're all joining it. That type of really blatant opportunist politics in the interest of accommodating various factions and various layers in the middle class. And that is not socialist politics. There may be members of those organizations who are dissatisfied with that. I know there are. They may be socialists, but a real socialist movement has to, and the real socialist movement doesn't accept these types of pragmatic answers. Our job that, oh, there's nothing other than the Democratic Party, or that in Sawant's case, you know, I'll accept the endorsements of the Democratic Party because it's just local Democrats or it's just local congresspersons or whatever. That a socialist party has to fight to pave the way, and it may be over a long historical process, although right now I think there are tremendous opportunities in the immediate situation to educate the working class as to its own independent strength. Not trick it, not tell it we're just pulling a little trick with the Democrats or the DSA, but to really fight. And this is, I think also on the question of the trade unions, it's really important to address this issue as well, because there isn't another political tendency in the world which takes the position which the World Socialist website takes on the trade unions. And this is very, very important. You may disagree, or you may have questions, or others may also ask us about this. But we call for the building of, as I mentioned earlier, rank and file committees in every workplace, linked together like the old committees of correspondence they had in the old revolutionary days in the United States. But these are organizations which are controlled by the workers. There's no bureaucrats. Nobody gets a $300,000 salary like the leadership of the teachers' unions and the UAW and the steelworkers and the Teamsters, etc., which have, by the way, they have hundreds of people each who make over $150,000. They're all grifting off of the dues money paid by workers. But the rank and file committees are democratically controlled by workers. Elected officials are subject to recall. And their fundamental purpose is to give workers the ability to organize and coordinate their social struggles across national boundaries. And that's fundamental, because the trade unions today are, they always have been, but they're national organizations. They're linked to the national corporations. They're linked to the national government. And so under conditions of globalization, the trade union, in the way, we hesitate to use the word union, because a union conjures up the images of the 1930s, the mass organizations of workers. These are not those same, they're sort of, don't get taken in by the fetish of language. These are organizations which collaborate with management. The financial interest of the executives of the trade unions, and they're not really leaders, they're executives, is to suppress the class struggle. For 50 years, no trade union has waged any significant social struggle. They've all been betrayed. PATCO, P9, and Hormel in Minnesota. The strikes in the mines in the late 1980s, and same with the late 1970s. The auto workers' strike of 2019, which was betrayed. Just shut down by the trade union. And so these other organizations are trying similarly to present a left cover to the trade unions, which also now in the United States, they're just part of the Democratic Party. There is no real distinction. They're not workers' organizations anymore. So that's the other obligation, I think, that that socialist organization has, is to fight to mobilize the working class within rank and file committees. If I could just say one more thing, that doesn't mean, by the way, that workers who are in trade unions, we conduct a tremendous amount of work among auto workers, among miners. Right now, there's a major strike of miners taking place outside of Birmingham, Alabama, at which just yesterday, a meeting of the held by the union, the UMWA, was broken up by workers who were shouting down the Cecil Roberts, the union president, who makes a ton of money, And the workers said, we want to take control of the situation ourselves. We don't need a union bureaucrat to come executive, rather to come and tell us that we're getting nothing in the contract, which is coming up. So that these are, I think, some of the obligations which a socialist party has.
Yeah, I would just say, I mean, I agree. But when you started off with the obligation of a socialist party is not to lie to the working class, you know, that I think that, I mean, when you just look at the numbers, you know, when you look at the numbers you listed off earlier in the podcast, I mean, we are living in a moment in history with the highest levels of wealth inequality in human history. You have someone like Jeff Bezos, who is worth $200 billion. Someone who in one day, I think during the pandemic, when working people couldn't keep their heads above water, he made like $13 billion in a single day. You know, three billionaires now own more wealth than half of our entire nation. And that is a direct result of our capitalist system. And I think when you have, you know, there's people who want to advocate, you know, because they're scared of the word socialism, or they think that socialism is going too far. And I hear from these people all the time, many of whom are my friends. And they say things like, well, we need, what we should have is social democracy. And what I would tell, what I always push back and say is, well, right now you guys are advocating for social democracy, and we have literally a corporate oligarchy. We have two capitalist parties who serve the interests of giant corporations and the billionaire class, and we have no party that actually serves the interests of the working class. And I think what's holding us back is the deception, is the lies that the Democratic Party keeps telling people that it represents the interests of the working class, when we see over and over again from the way they vote, you know, they didn't fight for the $15 minimum wage. It's not even a living wage. $24 an hour would be a living wage. They're not even fighting for Medicare for all in the middle of a pandemic. They're not fighting for green jobs and a Green New Deal in the middle of a climate crisis. You know, they're not representing the workers. And so for me, in my head, I just look at it really simply. Like, if we had a true socialist party in America, and a capitalist party, that would be a social democracy, right? There would be a party that represents business and a party that represents workers. But we don't have that. We have two parties that represent big business. And so if we ever want to move towards socialism, you can't already start, when you fight for social democracy, you're already compromising in the fight. You're already fighting for something smaller. Like, so it's like, if you did want social democracy, I mean, I want to move to a full socialist, workers own the means of production economy. But I think that for people who think that, I just think this kind of milquetoast, yeah, let's fight for social democracy. People have been trying to fight for social democracy for a century now. They've been trying to reform the Democratic Party and reform capitalism for a century. And what has been the result? The result has been that we are now living in this society with the highest levels of wealth and equality in human history. And things are getting worse and worse. 78% of the American people live paycheck to paycheck. You know, 60% of the country can't even afford a $600 emergency. And so we're in a moment now where half measures are going to avail us nothing. Fighting for just this kind of watered down social democracy is just going to continue to feed into the corporate oligarchy and what the DSA is doing. And so I would just encourage people, now is the time to be bold. We need to fight for everything. The capitalists fight for everything, you know, and the capitalist politicians, they go to the mat for their politicians. We need politicians and organizations that go to the mat for the working class and fight for a full socialist program. Stop watering things down when you're in the middle of campaigning or when you're protesting. And I think that really is the missing ingredient, that people are already just kind of, oh, well, we want Medicare for all and we want this. We're still not even getting that. You know what I mean?
Well, again, the issue is, I think, to be more concrete about it, the issue really is that the working class is the revolutionary social force. You know, this is, I think it really is. And that's not because socialists say so. It's because under capitalism, the working class is exploited on a massive scale. The surplus labor power of every individual worker is exploited by the capitalist class. But at the same time, that very relationship means that the working class occupies they are the only social force which is capable of leading the struggle to establish a world order based on, not on private profit, but based on rational planning and meeting of human need. Now, this again relates back to the DSA, and I because you said earlier, and it's not so much, I don't disagree with it, but you
Please.
Said you said, and tell me if you if I'm misquoting, but that, you know, capitalism has produced this level of social inequality. Now, obviously, that is correct, but that wasn't an automatic process. There were political forces which helped make sure that that took place. The trade unions really were fundamental to it. The deindustrialization of the Midwest was one example, but in every country, they've played the same role. The DSA has given the Democratic Party a left face over 40 years in which it carried out deregulation, the evisceration of any regulations on finance. That was in the US. In Europe, the left, so-called left, what we call the pseudo-left, the fake left, carried out the same policy. So yes, it is. There is an objective aspect to it, but these policies are really carried out by tendencies who are responsible for them. And this is why I'm raising it in the context of the focus which we place on the revolutionary role of the working class, because in the 60s and 70s, the DSA played a fundamental role in what it called the realignment of the Democratic Party. And they began saying, and actually Harrington, in an interview with the New York Times in 1984, says, there's nobody on the left who believes anymore that the working class is a revolutionary social force. He uses those words. It's sort of similar to what Ocasio-Cortez says when she says that class essentialists are deprioritizing human rights, the old anti-communist slander. But the DSA and middle class, you know, left radicals have tried to insert personal identity based on sex or based on race, skin color, or nationality. They have sought to completely realign political life on the left along the basis of cultural and racial and gender identity. That's identity politics. And it is fundamentally reactionary. It is incompatible with socialist politics, which stresses the need to unify workers of all races, and which understands that the only way to actually address prejudice and racial backwardness in the population is through the transformation of society. And so that's why, because I hope I'm making this point clearly, because
absolutely,
these are not, you know, automatic processes. There are tendencies which help prepare the ground for the level of confusion which you see today. I'll just say, in concluding this point, though, that when Ocasio-Cortez used this claim that you're privileged if you oppose Biden from a socialist standpoint, and that you don't care about black and brown people or undocumented people, well, obviously, it's easy to point to the blatant hypocrisy of saying that while Biden is jailing 20,000 immigrant children, victims of decades of imperialist devastation in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and other places. For us, really, the question of the unification of workers means absolute opposition to the politics based on that Harringtonite DSA position of identity, race, gender, socialists have to oppose that.
Well, and I would just take it a step further. I mean, my objection to the identity politics that have really dominated the Democratic Party is it's that they use identity politics as a kind of a way to pander for people's votes, but then they get into power and they're not actually like fighting for the communities that they say they represent. So what you come to find out is this whole identity politics game they're playing, they're just using that to protect their corporate power and to continue to govern for Wall Street and the giant corporations. You know, the Democratic Party will say that they're the party of black people, which, you know, it sounds great. Then they get into power and they are not fighting for reparations. You know, they're not fighting to defund the police and shift resources into black and brown communities. Actually, Joe Biden's calling for more police funding, right? And then you look at someone like Joe Biden, who was literally the architect of mass incarceration, which disproportionately locked up black and brown people. And so their rhetoric and their platitudes don't actually match their track record and actually the policies that they're fighting for right now. So that's the problem I have. I mean, you know, they, as an LGBTQ person, you know, they pander to my community all the time. and to get votes. But then they're not actually fighting for working class LGBTQ people who need healthcare, right? They're not actually, so that's my issue with it, is that it's more of that deception and that trickery. You know, they're not actually backing up the rhetoric and the platitudes they use to pander for votes to actually fight for these marginalized communities. They're actually, in many instances, they're fighting against these marginalized communities because they're funneling more money up to their corporate donors. And so for me, I would argue that a socialist program will actually help marginalized communities. It will help the poor. It will help the working class. It will help people of color. It will help Black people. It will help women who continue to be pushed down in our decrepit capitalist system. And I think this kind of also relates to kind of what we're seeing, you know, with the whole, you know, I'm a big figure on social media. And so I understand that I get a lot of criticism and I take a lot of criticism and I'm perfectly okay with that. I mean, someone told me yesterday, they're like, what I'm so grateful is you absorb most of the criticisms from your, so your comrades don't have to deal with it, so that we can fight and organize and do all our thing. And I'm fine with dealing with criticism. I get that it comes with the territory. But what I've noticed from AOC's fan base and even some people, some very kind of loyal DSA members is, you know, that it is kind of like, someone told me yesterday that AOC is quote unquote unassailable. And that I'm a racist and a misogynist for simply repeating what AOC herself said and did, right? That I'm calling her out for giving grassroots donations away to corporate Democrats who fight against the very progressive program that AOC and the squad say they care about. And that makes me a racist and a misogynist. And so I looked up the definition of the word unassailable because I heard it from a few people. And literally the definition of unassailable means, and I quote, unable to be attacked or questioned. Eric, do people who believe that a leader is unassailable and is unable to be attacked or criticized or questioned, and people who weaponize identity politics to deflect from valid criticism of AOC, do they belong to a political party or do they belong to a cult of personality? Because I'm seeing a lot of cult of personality here where it's like AOC is now more important than the movement and more important than actually fighting for the policies that will uplift the poor and the working class and communities of color. Like, that's the vibe I'm getting. It's a very cult of personality vibe where she can do no wrong. How dare you criticize her? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's how the Democratic Party works. The Democratic Party has always used identity politics in its very many variant ways as a blunt object to use against socialism and against the left. You know, there's so many examples of this that I can't even really go into detail. But I would say that the use of politics, which is based on categories like race and gender, are fundamentally anti-socialist in their very root, because there is no such thing as a community. If you want to, I mean, obviously you could talk about cultural trends and that's somewhat of a different issue, but I mean, among the Black population in the United States, there is a ruling class. There are Black people who are members of the capitalist class. Vast majority of the Black population belongs to the working class. And in fact, if you just take this as an example, inequality within the African-American population in the United States is far greater, actually, than it even is among white people, if you want to use these terms.
Yep.
The same is actually true among Latinos. Inequality among Latinos, the share of the wealth which is owned by the richest 10%, and of course among white people, it's incredibly unequal either, as it is incredibly unequal as well. But it just gives a sense. I mean, 60% of the Black population in the United States has negative net worth, debt, incredible poverty. The most deplorable conditions remain in the major cities and in the rural parts of the South, despite the fact that the Democratic Party has been promoting itself as the party of Black people, you know, and this is an attack on the conditions of the working class. But it does require, in order to really address the fundamental class questions, that we do have to take a position against the effort to present one's skin color as though you know, it is a de facto, makes you a de facto ally of every other member of your race. You know, a black worker is no less the ally of Barack Obama than I am of Donald Trump. It's critical that socialists really give no quarter to the argument that that there is a sort of community based on race or based on gender. That's an absolutely an ABC of class politics.
Now, well, I can add a little nuance myself. I mean, I just believe it's a false choice to choose between racial justice and economic justice. I think that you can, yes, the class-based analysis is so important, but I don't think that it means you can't have a race-based analysis as well. I think that, like you've said, that disproportionately, I mean, one of the statistics I quote often is that the black-white wealth gap in America today is as wide today in 2021 as it was back in the civil rights movement. So inequality hits the black community harder than the white community, right? These issues of injustice, issues of police brutality, when you go down the line.
What do you mean by white community? What do you mean by black community?
I mean that when you look at the data, that inequality is more rampant in the black community than it is with, you know, with white people. I would argue that goes back to just the history of this country. And just like the working class has been suppressed, there is a history of suppression and, you know, you go back to slavery. I mean, there is a history of oppression when it comes to black people that, and again, I'm not saying I just don't think we have to choose between race and class. I think that both analyses are important. I think that you can have both. I think that socialist policies lift up black people in a way that the program of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party completely ignores the majority of black people in this country. And so I don't think that, I think we need both. That's my opinion. I think that the struggles of my black comrades are, you know, they've had a steeper hill in many ways. And that's based on things like redlining and, you know, you can go trace it all the way back to slavery, being, you know, having voting rights removed. You know, there's a lot of reasons, but I don't think that I'm not saying that you can't have a class analysis. I just don't think we should completely throw out the race analysis as well. I think you can fight for both racial justice and economic justice. Why should we choose?
Well, the fundamental issue is to understand where racism comes from. And that can only really be done through an economic understanding. And that actually racism didn't, because this came up in the World Socialist website in 2019 entered into a polemical argument with the New York Times, which promoted this 1619 campaign, project rather. And the Times argued that and I'd encourage everybody out there to go and read some of the material which was published on this. The Times argued that racism is in the DNA of the United States, assigning a genetic trait, in particular to white people. And this was just a completely reactionary and actually really bordering on fascistic, drawing certainly from fascist ideology, about the intrinsic differences between the races. And actually, Stacey Abrams, the Democrat, used that term in an interview she did with Current Affairs, in which she actually argued that there are intrinsic differences between the races. Now, that's absurd. We reject that absolutely categorically. But socialists, of course, recognize the existence of racism. There is profound social backwardness. One sees this not only in the United States. These are problems which exist under capitalism, but these are themselves.
And I would say that's absolutely true, that it's capitalism and racism are, you can't have one without the other. They go hand in hand.
Yeah.
So it absolutely is. I mean, dealing with the great economic despair in the black community, it is a socialist issue. It always has been, because it's capitalism that has disproportionately kept black people from achieving their full potential in this country. And so it's for me, I look at it as it's baked into the system. It in many ways, I feel like capitalism and racism, they're two sides of the same coin. I mean, they're very intertwined. And so I think our analysis, it's important, in my opinion, to have an analysis that is nuanced, that doesn't say that, you know, because I think what the Democratic Party says is that class doesn't matter. You know, and they do all this kind of, it's all identity politics, and then they don't even actually help the marginalized communities that they pander to for votes. And I would say that that is not right, that class matters, but in many ways in this country that race matters and the racism that my black and brown brothers and sisters have had to go through. I make no qualms about that. They have had a steeper path. And many of that is because of our capitalist system that was developed to benefit white people. Let's not forget that the Constitution, it's baked into that. You know, it was white people who were given land, right, at the founding of this country. And so in that respect, I don't think like the Democrats want to ignore class and kind of use this pandering identity politics. I would say that it is important to understand that it is very important to recognize class, but also to recognize the racial struggle as well. And that you can have a socialist party that does both, that is about the class struggle and understanding that the class struggle has been even harder for our black and brown brothers and sisters and non-binary siblings.
Well, the way to address the social crisis which confronts workers, regardless of what color their skin happens to be, is through expropriating the wealth of the rich, regardless of what color the skin, what skin color the capitalist who's being expropriated happens to have, and transferring trillions of dollars from the corporations into the hands of workers in the United States and in every country around the world, regardless of their gender, regardless of their sexual orientation, regardless of their race. And under socialism, in the absence of a scarcity of resources, and ultimately in the absence of a ruling class, there will be no basis for pitting workers against each other based on prejudices, whether those are religious prejudices or national prejudices or racial ones. That's the solution. But reaching that point requires uniting the working class, no matter what race. And that's the fundamental issue. One of the reasons why the Democratic Party's racial obsession, and it really is an obsession with racial politics and gender politics, has cleared the way for Donald Trump in many ways, is because there's an opposition in the population, not only among white people, by the way, again, if you want to use that category. Trump's in 2020, Trump won. We wrote an article on the World Socialist website. I don't want to quote exact percentages off the top of my head because I don't want to misstate the actual fact. But I believe that Trump doubled or tripled the amount of votes he won from African American people in the 2020 election versus the 2016 election. And actually, so these are, you know, the point I'm making is that it's that, and the same process takes place in France, in Germany, where the politics of the so-called left in those countries have paved the way for the emergence of groups like the Alternative for Germany in Germany, or the National Front in France, etc. But yeah, for us, I think the issue is often seen improperly in the way that it's framed. The socialist position is that it is essential to politically unify workers of all races. The Democratic Party position is that race is the fundamental issue, and that if you talk about class, you're a class essentialist, and you're deprioritizing human rights, as Ocasio-Cortez said.
Right. And I would just take it a step further that while the Democratic Party pretends like it prioritizes race, that it actually isn't helping the people that it panders to. And that, to me, is a real indictment on the party. I mean, if they are the party of black people, why aren't they fighting for reparations, right? Why aren't they fighting to defund the police and shift resources into black and brown communities? It's like they just want to control segments of the population to get power and to keep them trapped into the Democratic Party without actually giving them policies that improve the material conditions of their life. And what I hear from you and what I hear from many socialists is that it is about improving the material conditions of the working class, having an economy that is of, by, and for the working class, and not an economy that is owned and controlled by these giant corporations and the billionaire class, which just continue to get richer and richer while everyone else is struggling to keep their heads above water. I want to go back and just kind of touch on some of the AOC loyalists and fan base and such, because the pattern that I see is that the leftists who are afraid of any criticism of AOC or Bernie or the squad, they've placed all of their faith in trying to reform and move the corrupt Democratic Party left. So they treat even valid criticisms as an attack on their belief system. But as we've talked about during this podcast, both history and our current reality show that the Democratic Party cannot be reformed or move left and will always put the interests of the capitalist class over the working class, which means that dissent and criticism of the Democratic Party should never be silenced because it is our main tool to help wake people up to the harsh reality that we face. You recently tweeted, "The point is not that Ocasio-Cortez personally betrayed the left, but the point is that this experience shows the dead end of working within the Democratic Party. Socialism means building a movement of the working class independent of both parties. We need to learn the lessons of history." Closing thoughts here, what would you like to say to the people who still disagree with us and believe that the Democratic Party can be reformed or move left?
Well, I would say rethink that position. There will be future AOCs. There's Nina Turner in Ohio who's attempting to present herself as one. There are a number of other brand new Congress candidates. There will be even Ocasio-Cortez's in the future who say that they're actually independent of the Democratic Party formally, but they will play a similar role in bringing people ultimately back into the political orbit of the Democratic Party. I would say to those people, to prevent yourself from being misled, it is really fundamental now that we study the lessons of the historical experiences of the class struggle, and that we recognize that what socialism means is it's the fight for the international unity of the working class and the fight for its political independence from all the political parties in every country, all the institutions of the capitalist state. And trying to reform the Democratic Party by joining it and pressuring it to the left is like trying to get on the board of directors at Amazon and trying to push it to the left. It's the exact same. That may sound like a joke, but it's the exact same.
No, I'm laughing because it's so true.
Yeah. Or of joining the CIA to try and become its director so that you can, you know, have it implement left-wing policies. I mean, if those who somehow still believe that the Democratic Party can be reformed had better hit the books, because they are making mistakes that have been made for over 100 years. The product of those mistakes is massive levels of social inequality, war, horrific crimes carried out by American imperialism under the guise of progressive politics domestically. So don't let yourself be a dupe for such crimes. Break with the Democratic Party and become a genuine socialist. And read the World Socialist website.
Yes. How do we build solidarity? Because I think there's a lot of people that are coming to the conclusion that neither one of these corporate parties are on our side. But we're starting to see a lot of fragmentation, right? You know, we have the Green Party, which is now eco-socialist. We have, you know, Socialist Equality Party. We have the Party of Socialism and Liberation. We have Socialist Alternative. You know, we have the Socialist Revolution Party, which is another international, you know, Marxist tendency party. How do we try to find some solidarity amongst all of those efforts to have kind of one collective socialist movement to fight back against our decrepit capitalist system and to start getting victories and representation for the working class? Because I see that as one of everyone, you know, we all have, it's like, I feel like, you know, I'm kind of soft supporting. I soft support the Socialist Equality Party. I have soft support for Party of Socialism and Liberation, for Socialist Alternative, for the Green Party. I mean, I'm trying to, because I, as a commentator, I also, you know, I've made mistakes of kind of overly committing before I knew what was the right direction. And to be honest to my audience and to you, I don't, like, the only thing I know for certain is that the path to the fundamental change we need in this country for the working class is not going to happen in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. It is that I'm 100% certain on that. What I'm not so certain about is what is the right vehicle for us to have an independent working class party and to build a revolutionary socialist movement to move beyond capitalism. And one of the things that I'm starting to want to do more is, I, you know, we've got the Trotskyists, the Marxist-Lenin, and, you know, I know the different tendencies and I'm learning about that, but I still, for everyone who is done with the Democratic Party, I want there to be some kind of solidarity there because the people who are done with the corrupt duopoly, I think we have so much in common, and it's a shame for us to kind of be going at each other. What do you have to say on that?
Well, that's a complex question. I would say a couple of things. Number one, these groups, left tendencies, have to support one another's democratic right to exist, to not be censored, like the World Socialist website is being censored by Google. There has been silence from all of those groups, which you mentioned, on the censorship of the World Socialist website.
I spoke up about it a few months ago.
No, I know you did, yes. And that's very critical. And you deserve credit despite your differences with us on various questions as they may arise. You've taken a principled position. Principled politics is not afraid of conflict. Disagreeing
and
on,
debate, right? Yeah, debate. What we're doing right now is very important.
Absolutely. In fact, conflict is a necessary ingredient in the fight for socialist politics because it isn't, you know, there's this idea which has pervaded, and really it comes from the Democratic Party, that left politics is just all about splits and splinters and that it's just a bunch of infighting. Well, actually, there are political issues involved. And we have, as you say, fundamental differences with Kashama Sawant and Socialist Alternative. But we called on the mayor to conduct an investigation when she faced fascist threats to kill her, which ended up coming from within the city government. But the point that I'm trying to make is that there has to be an understanding among the people who are coming into politics that conflict leads to political clarity. And we're talking about questions which, for the orientation of the working class, are life or death questions. Whether there will be a third world war or whether the working class will be able to stop it from taking place. There needs to be, and at times, very blunt, very fierce, very direct discussion, and I would say debate instead of discussion, actually, on these types of questions. And the tendency which takes the correct political line will win the loyalty of the working class. And that's the culture which has to be created.
And what's interesting, not to interject, but I find it so interesting because this has been about kind of the whole AOC story and what that says and what that means about how the left should move forward. But what I found most interesting, and I'm glad you've heard from some DSA members who were upset with kind of the hostility from AOC and wanting to push back against her and the DSA, because I've heard from DSA people and AOC stands who just, their first reaction when they hear, you know, about what that AOC is giving money to corporate Democrats, their first reaction is to kind of shut the debate up and to say, stop criticizing, stop tweeting about this, stop talking about this. And then they actually take it a step further. There's a lot of lashing out, and personally, instead of responding to my points or anyone's points that are like, yeah, we supported a grassroots progressive movement to fight for Medicare for all. We aren't a part of a movement to actually give money to candidates who oppose Medicare for all. I mean, I think what AOC did, she's not leading a leftist movement. She's really stabbing it in the back by giving money to corporate Democrats. It's so blatant. And then I think the response from a lot of DSA people and her, what I call fan base now, has just been to kind of lash out. And I've received so many personal attacks. Well, yeah, a year and a half ago, you initially supported Warren before you backed Bernie. And it's like, yes, I initially supported Warren. And then I realized that was a mistake. And so after the first two states, I got behind Bernie and endorsed him. And things change. Politics is fluid. Just like I've changed. And now I went from, you know, almost 3-4 years ago, I was a centrist, you could call me. Now I consider myself a socialist, a revolutionary socialist. In the same way that I've changed, I'm just commenting on the fact that AOC has changed. And the person she was in 2018 that was, you know, fighting against the corrupt establishment, where's the fight? She's not showing us any fight now. You know, she's fighting to defend Joe Biden and defend the corrupt establishment that she ran against. And so, but my point is just pointing that out, like she's changing and going toward the center. They don't respond and want to debate that. They just want to personally shut you up and attack you. And I think that is so dangerous to silence the debate. And that's actually the same thing we see from liberals and from, you know, kind of the blue mega crowd who want to just defend anything Biden and Pelosi does. Their first instinct is to shut up the debate. And I think if we're ever going to move forward and the left is going to move forward and we have a socialist movement, it's going to require not shutting people up, all of us, to debate and to listen to our fellow, you know, comrades in the struggle.
Well, the tradition that you're referring to on the left is the tradition of Stalinism. And the tradition of the Stalinist movement was not only to shut up and attack personally, but to kill their political opponents. During the latter half of the 1930s, between 1936 and 1939, Stalinists murdered about 800,000 supporters of Trotsky and the left opposition and other independent thinkers in the Soviet Union. I'm not accusing everybody who maybe needs to take a deep breath and grow up a little bit of being a Stalinist or equating their activity with mass murder. But I do think that politics has to... People, I would say, many of those are just dishonest people. I wouldn't waste your breath with them. But I would say to the people who are...
And I would say that the people that I see here aren't Stalinists. I mean, they're like, they're more to the right of
fine,
me.
Fine, that's the tradition.
They're very... Yeah. Right, yeah. I would call them social democrats. I mean, I would actually say that AOC herself is not a socialist. She's fighting for social democracy. And same with DSA. I mean, the more I've learned, like, DSA itself is really kind of fighting for just social democracy. They're not fighting for... workers own the means of production, socialism, which is true, right? Socialism.
Well, neither were the Stalinists. But the point that I'm making is more that people have to sort of understand there are traditions among socialists, there are traditions in left politics, and the tradition of shutting people up and I would add the tradition of not supporting the World Socialist website when it is censored is part of a very unprincipled tradition in left politics. Mm. Now, but I, just to answer the other element of your question, I mean, the Socialist Equality Party has a history. We have a record. We have well-documented past struggles, positions which our movement has taken on literally every issue going back to the Russian Revolution. And in order to sort of understand what a political tendency is, you have to understand its history. That maybe is not something which many people have learned yet, but there's no way to understand what a party is fighting for at present without understanding what it has dedicated itself over the course of many, many, many decades to fighting for. And we, of course, we will defend our heritage. We will defend and we will fight for the program which the Socialist Equality Party has advancing. There are very many differences with other groups which call themselves socialist. We'll continue to defend those differences and to hash them out, because it's actually only through clarifying what those differences are that we can train and develop a cadre of young Marxists and Marxists of all ages, no matter how new they are to revolutionary politics, in what the struggle for socialism really is. So I would just encourage everybody out there, read the Statement of Principles of the Socialist Equality Party. Study the Historical and International Foundations document, which explains our movement's past and what it has fought for, what we are and what we aren't. And I think that those are very critical, and it's required to really fight for socialism today.
Eric, thank you. We went a little over, but I really enjoy talking with you. Thank you for your principled approach and for your just coming on and for the debate and open exchange of ideas. And thank you for everything you guys are doing. I encourage all my listeners to read the World Socialist website and to follow you on Twitter. How can people follow you on Twitter? Because you're a brilliant writer. Your article, I think, just really encapsulated and showed that this issue is not just about AOC. This is just a long pattern of the Democratic Party of co-opting socialist movements and then essentially destroying socialist movements to stop any real change to the left. And you kind of added this context to it that I think a lot of people were missing. And a lot of people are thinking, why are you guys criticizing AOC? She's one person. Like, no, this is a pattern that has emerged now for the Democratic Party. And your article just really brilliantly summed that up. So how can people, I know you share a lot of your work on Twitter. How can people follow you on Twitter?
Well, you can look me up, Eric London, SEP. But I would say, though, I mean, there are good articles, but this is the product of an entire movement. And there are a number of people who have written material on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the DSA in particular, comrades internationally. This, I would say you can follow me. I just read my name. Follow David North. He's the international chairman of the editorial board of the World Socialist website and the national chairman of the Socialist Equality Party. And follow Joe Kishore. He's our national secretary. He was our presidential candidate. There's tons of World Socialist website writers you've got to follow and read the World Socialist website every day. Put it in your bookmark and check it when you wake up every morning.
Awesome. Eric, thank you for coming on today, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight. And before we go, I want to take this moment to thank our benefactors who contribute $20 a month to the show to keep this show alive and going. So I want to thank Kenny Ballantyne, Tyler Sambucci, Nate Tecito, Lloyd Chapman, Ed Romo, John Littman, John Paul DeLuca, Susan Sarandon, DJ Comatose, Patty Cleary, and Elizabeth Kim. Thank you so much for your generous donations. And thank you, everyone, for supporting the podcast and supporting my work. I really appreciate it. Again, go to patreon.com/ampedup if you want to support the podcast as well. And for as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our bonus content. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.